Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. This book is divided into 127 chapters. For Kenneth Litauer, a man of gallantry and taste. Nothing in this book is true. Live by the FOMA, harmless untruths, that make you brave and kind and healthy and happy. The Books of Bokonin, Chapter 1, Verse 5. Cat's Cradle. Chapter 1. The Day the World Ended. Call me Jonah. My parents did, or nearly did. They called me John. Jonah, John. If I had been a Sam, I would have been a Jonah still. Not because I have been unlucky for others, but because somebody or something has compelled me to be certain places at certain times, without fail. Conveyances and motives, both conventional and bizarre, have been provided. And according to plan, at each appointed second, at each appointed place, this Jonah was there. Listen. When I was a younger man, two wives ago, 250,000 cigarettes ago, 3,000 quarts of booze ago, when I was a much younger man, I began to collect material for a book to be called The Day the World Ended. The book was to be factual. The book was to be an account of what important Americans had done on the day when the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Japan. It was to be a Christian book. I was a Christian then. I am a Bokoninist now. I would have been a Bokoninist then, if there had been anyone to teach me the bittersweet lies of Bokonin. But Bokoninism was unknown beyond the gravel beaches and coral knives that ring this little island in the Caribbean Sea, the Republic of San Lorenzo. We Bokoninists believe that humanity is organized into teams, teams that do God's will without ever discovering what they're doing. Such a team is called a carass by Bokonin, and the instrument, the can-can, that brought me into my own particular carass was the book I never finished, the book to be called The Day the World Ended. Chapter 2. Nice, nice, very nice. If you find your life tangled up with somebody else's life for no very logical reasons, writes Bokonin, that person may be a member of your carass. At another point in the books of Bokonin, he tells us, man created the checkerboard, God created the carass. By that he means that a carass ignores national, institutional, occupational, familial, and class boundaries. It is as free-form as an amoeba. In his 53rd Calypso, Bokonin invites us to sing along with him, oh, a sleeping drunkard up in Central Park, and a lion hunter in the jungle dark, and a Chinese dentist and a British queen, all fit together in the same machine. Nice, nice, very nice. Nice, nice, very nice. Nice, nice, very nice. So many different people in the same device. Chapter 3. Folly. Nowhere does Bokonin warn against a person's trying to discover the limits of his carass and the nature of the work God Almighty has had it do. Bokonin simply observes that such investigations are bound to be incomplete. In the autobiographical section of the books of Bokonin, he writes a parable on the folly of pretending to discover, to understand. I once knew an Episcopalian lady in Newport, Rhode Island, who asked me to design and build a doghouse for her Great Dane. The lady claimed to understand God and his ways of working perfectly. She could not understand why anyone should be puzzled about what had been or what was going to be. And yet when I showed her a blueprint of the doghouse I proposed to build, she said to me, I'm sorry, but I never could read one of those things. Give it to your husband or your minister to pass it on to God, I said. And when God finds a minute, I'm sure he'll explain this doghouse of mine in a way that even you can understand. She fired me. I shall never forget her. She believed that God liked people in sailboats better than he liked people in motorboats. She could not bear to look at a worm. When she saw a worm, she screamed. She was a fool, and so am I, and so is anyone who thinks he sees what God is doing, writes Bokonin. Chapter 4. A Tentative Tangling of Tendrils. Be that as it may, I intend in this book to include as many members of my carass as possible, and I mean to examine all strong hints as to what on earth we, collectively, have been up to. I do not intend that this book be a tract on behalf of Bokoninism. I should like to offer a Bokoninist warning about it, however. The first sentence in the books of Bokonin is this. All of the true things I am about to tell you are shameless lies. My Bokoninist warning is this. Anyone unable to understand how a useful religion can be founded on lies will not understand this book either. So be it. About my carass, then. It surely includes the three children of Dr. Felix Honecker, one of the so-called fathers of the first atomic bomb. Dr. Honecker himself was no doubt a member of my cuirass, though he was dead before my sinukas, the tendrils of my life, began to tangle with those of his children. The first of his heirs to be touched by my sinukas was Newton Honecker, the youngest of his three children, the younger of his two sons. I learned from the publication of my fraternity, the Delta Upsilon Quarterly, that Newton Honecker, son of the Nobel Prize physicist, Felix Honecker, had been pledged by my chapter, the Cornell chapter. So I wrote this letter to Newt. Dear Mr. Honecker, or should I say, dear Brother Honecker, I am a Cornell DU, now making my living as a freelance writer. I am gathering material for a book relating to the first atomic bomb. Its contents will be limited to events that took place on August 6, 1945, the day the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. Since your late father is generally recognized as having been one of the chief creators of the bomb, I would very much appreciate any anecdotes you might care to give me of life in your father's house on the day the bomb was dropped. I am sorry to say that I don't know as much about your illustrious family as I should, and so don't know whether you have brothers or sisters. If you do have brothers and sisters, I should like very much to have their addresses, so that I can send similar requests to them. I realize that you were very young when the bomb was dropped, which is all to the good. My book is going to emphasize the human, rather than the technical side of the bomb, so recollections of the day through the eyes of a baby, if you will pardon the expression, would fit in perfectly. You don't have to worry about style and form. Leave all that to me. Just give me the bare bones of your story. I will, of course, submit the final version to you for your approval prior to publication. Fraternally yours. Chapter 5. Letter from a Pre-Med. To which Newt replied, I am sorry to be so long about answering your letter. That sounds like a very interesting book you're doing. I was so young when the bomb was dropped that I don't think I'm going to be much help. You should really ask my brother and sister, who are both older than I am. My sister is Mrs. Harrison C. Connors, 4918 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana. That is my home address, too, now. I think she will be glad to help you. Nobody knows where my brother Frank is. He disappeared right after Father's funeral 2 years ago, and nobody has heard from him since. For all we know, he may be dead now. I was only 6 years old when they dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, so anything I remember about that day, other people have helped me to remember. I remember I was playing on the living room carpet outside my father's study door in Ilium, New York. The door was open, and I could see my father. He was wearing pajamas and a bathrobe. He was smoking a cigar. He was playing with a loop of string. Father was staying home from the laboratory in his pajamas all day that day. He stayed home whenever he wanted to. Father, as you probably know, spent practically his whole professional life working for the research laboratory of the General Forge and Foundry Company in Ilium. When the Manhattan Project came along, the bomb project, Father wouldn't leave Ilium to work on it. He said he wouldn't work on it at all unless they let him work where he wanted to work. A lot of the time that meant at home. The only place he liked to go, outside of Ilium, was our cottage on Cape Cod. Cape Cod was where he died. He died on a Christmas Eve. You probably know that, too. Anyway, I was playing on the carpet outside his study on the day of the bomb. My sister Angela tells me I used to play with little toy trucks for hours, making motor sounds, going, Burton, 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 all the time. So I guess I was going, Burton, 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 on the day of the bomb. And Father was in his study, playing with a loop of string. Now, it so happens, I know where the string he was playing with came from. Maybe you can use it somewhere in your book. Father took the string from around the manuscript of a novel that a man in prison had sent him. The novel was about the end of the world in the year 2000, and the name of the book was 2000 A.D. It told about how mad scientists made a terrific bomb that wiped out the whole world. There was a big sex orgy when everybody knew that the world was going to end, and then Jesus Christ himself appeared 10 seconds before the bomb went off. The name of the author was Marvin Sharp Holderness, and he told Father in a covering letter that he was in prison for killing his own brother. He sent the manuscript to Father because he couldn't figure out what kind of explosives to put in the bomb. He thought maybe Father could make suggestions. I don't mean to tell you, I read the book when I was 6. We had it around the house for years. My brother Frank made it his personal property on account of the dirty parts. Frank kept it hidden in what he called his wall safe in his bedroom. Actually, it wasn't a safe, but just an old stove flue with a tin lid. Frank and I must have read the orgy part 1,000 times when we were kids. We had it for years, and then my sister Angela found it. She read it and said it was nothing but a piece of dirty, rotten filth. She burned it up, and the string with it. She was a mother to Frank and me, because our real mother died when I was born. My father never read the book, I'm pretty sure. I don't think he ever read a novel or even a short story in his whole life, or at least not since he was a little boy. He didn't read his mail or magazines or newspapers either. I suppose he read a lot of technical journals, but to tell you the truth, I can't remember my father reading anything. As I say, all he wanted from that manuscript was the string. That was the way he was. Nobody could predict what he was going to be interested in next. On the day of the bomb, it was string. Have you ever read the speech he made when he accepted the Nobel Prize? This is the whole speech. Ladies and gentlemen, I stand before you now because I never stopped dawdling like an 8-year-old on a spring morning on his way to school. Anything can make me stop and look and wonder and sometimes learn. I am a very happy man. Thank you. Anyway, Father looked at that loop of string for a while, and then his fingers started playing with it. His fingers made the string figure called a cat's cradle. I don't know where Father learned how to do that. From his father, maybe. His father was a tailor, you know, so there must have been thread and string around all the time when Father was a boy. Making the cat's cradle was the closest I ever saw my father come to playing what anybody else would call a game. He had no use at all for tricks and games and rules that other people made up. In a scrapbook my sister Angela used to keep, there was a clipping from Time magazine where somebody asked Father what games he played for relaxation, and he said, "Why should I bother with made-up games when there are so many real ones going on?" He must have surprised himself when he made a cat's cradle out of the string, and maybe it reminded him of his own childhood. He all of a sudden came out of his study and did something he'd never done before. He tried to play with me. Not only had he never played with me before, he had hardly ever even spoken to me. But he went down on his knees on the carpet next to me, and he showed me his teeth, and he waved that tangle of string in my face. "See? See? See?" he asked. "Cat's cradle. See the cat's cradle? See where the nice pussycat sleeps? Meow! Meow!" His pores looked as big as craters on the moon. His ears and nostrils were stuffed with hair. Cigar smoke made him smell like the mouth of hell. So close up, my father was the ugliest thing I had ever seen. I dream about it all the time. And then he sang "Rockabye Catsy" in the treetop. He sang, "When the wind blows, the cradle will rock. If the bough breaks, the cradle will fall. Down will come cradle, catsy and all." I burst into tears. I jumped up and ran out of the house as fast as I could go. I have to sign off here. It's after 2 in the morning. My roommate just woke up and complained about the noise from the typewriter. Chapter 6. Bug Fights. Newt resumed his letter the next morning. He resumed it as follows. Next morning. Here I go again, fresh as a daisy after 8 hours of sleep. The fraternity house is very quiet now. Everybody is in class but me. I'm a very privileged character. I don't have to go to class anymore. I was flunked out last week. I was a pre-med. They were right to flunk me out. I would have made a lousy doctor. After I finish this letter, I think I'll go to a movie. Or, if the sun comes out, maybe I'll go for a walk through one of the gorges. Aren't the gorges beautiful? This year, 2 girls jumped into one holding hands. They didn't get into the sorority they wanted. They wanted Tri-Delt. But, back to August 6, 1945. My sister Angela has told me many times that I really hurt my father that day when I wouldn't admire the cat's cradle, when I wouldn't stay there on the carpet with my father and listen to him sing. Maybe I did hurt him, but I don't think I could have hurt him much. He was one of the best protected human beings who ever lived. People couldn't get at him because he just wasn't interested in people. I remember one time, about a year before he died, I tried to get him to tell me something about my mother. He couldn't remember anything about her. Did you ever hear the famous story about breakfast on the day Mother and Father were leaving for Sweden to accept the Nobel Prize? It was in the Saturday Evening Post one time. Mother cooked a big breakfast, and then when she cleared off the table, she found a quarter and a dime and 3 pennies by Father's coffee cup. He tipped her. After wounding my father so terribly, if that's what I did, I ran out into the yard. I didn't know where I was going until I found my brother Frank under a big spirea bush. Frank was 12 then, and I wasn't surprised to find him under there. He spent a lot of time under there on hot days. Just like a dog, he'd make a hollow in the cool earth all around the roots. And you could never tell what Frank would have under the bush with him. One time he had a dirty book, another time he had a bottle of cooking sherry. On the day they dropped the bomb, Frank had a tablespoon and a mason jar. What he was doing was spooning different kinds of bugs into the jar and making them fight. The bug fight was so interesting that I stopped crying right away. Forgot all about the old man. I can't remember what all Frank had fighting in the jar that day, but I can remember other bug fights we staged later on. One stag beetle against 100 red ants. One centipede against 3 spiders. Red ants against black ants. They won't fight unless you keep shaking the jar. And that's what Frank was doing. Shaking, shaking the jar. After a while, Angela came looking for me. She lifted up one side of the bush and said, "So there you are." She asked Frank what he thought he was doing, and he said, "Experimenting." That's what Frank always used to say when people asked him what he thought he was doing. He always said, "Experimenting." Angela was 22 then. She had been the real head of the family since she was 16, since Mother died, since I was born. She used to talk about how she had 3 children, me, Frank, and Father. She wasn't exaggerating either. I can remember cold mornings when Frank, Father, and I would all be in a line in the front hall, and Angela would be bundling us up, treating us exactly the same. Only I was going to kindergarten, Frank was going to junior high, and Father was going to work on the atom bomb. I remember one morning like that when the oil burner had quit, the pipes were frozen, and the car wouldn't start. We all sat there in the car while Angela kept pushing the starter until the battery was dead. And then Father spoke up. You know what he said? He said, "I wonder about turtles." "What do you wonder about turtles?" Angela asked him. "When they pull in their heads," he said, "do their spines buckle or contract?" Angela was one of the unsung heroines of the atom bomb, incidentally, and I don't think the story has ever been told. Maybe you can use it. After the turtle incident, Father got so interested in turtles that he stopped working on the atom bomb. Some people from the Manhattan Project finally came out to the house to ask Angela what to do. She told them to take away Father's turtles. So, one night, they went into his laboratory and stole the turtles and the aquarium. Father never said a word about the disappearance of the turtles. He just came to work the next day and looked for things to play with and think about, and everything there was to play with and think about had something to do with the bomb. When Angela got me out from under the bush, she asked me what had happened between Father and me. I just kept saying over and over again how ugly he was, how much I hated him. So she slapped me. "How dare you say that about your father," she said. "He's one of the greatest men who ever lived. He won the war today. Do you realize that? He won the war." She slapped me again. I don't blame Angela for slapping me. Father was all she had. She didn't have any boyfriends. She didn't have any friends at all. She had only one hobby. She played the clarinet. I told her again how much I hated my father. She slapped me again. And then Frank came out from under the bush and punched her in the stomach. It hurt her something awful. She fell down and she rolled around. When she got her wind back, she cried and she yelled for Father. "He won't come," Frank said, and he laughed at her. Frank was right. Father stuck his head out of a window and he looked at Angela and me rolling on the ground, bawling, and Frank standing over us, laughing. The old man pulled his head indoors again, and never asked later what all the fuss had been about. People weren't his specialty. Will that do? Is that any help to your book? Of course, you really tied me down, asking me to stick to the day of the bomb. There are lots of other good anecdotes about the bomb and Father, from other days. For instance, do you know the story about Father on the day they first tested the bomb out at Alamogordo? After the thing went off, after it was a sure thing that America could wipe out a city with just one bomb, a scientist turned to Father and said, "Science has now known sin." And do you know what Father said? He said, "What is sin?" All the best, Newton Honecker. Chapter 7. The Illustrious Honeckers. Newt added these 3 postscripts to his letter. P.S. I can't sign myself fraternally yours because they won't let me be your brother on account of my grades. I was only a pledge, and now they're going to take even that away from me. P.P.S. You call our family illustrious, and I think you would maybe be making a mistake if you called it that in your book. I'm a midget, for instance, 4 feet tall. And the last we heard of my brother Frank, he was wanted by the Florida police, the FBI, and the Treasury Department for running stolen cars to Cuba on war surplus LSTs. So I'm pretty sure illustrious isn't quite the word you're after. Glamorous is probably closer to the truth. PPPS, 24 hours later. I have reread this letter, and I can see where somebody might get the impression that I don't do anything but sit around and remember sad things and pity myself. Actually, I'm a very lucky person, and I know it. I am about to marry a wonderful little girl. There is enough love in this world for everybody, if people will just look. I am proof of that. Chapter 8. Newt's Thing with Zinka. Newt did not tell me who his girlfriend was, but about 2 weeks after he wrote to me, everybody in the country knew that her name was Zinka. Plain Zinka. Apparently she didn't have a last name. Zinka was a Ukrainian midget, a dancer with the Borzoi Dance Company. As it happened, Newt saw a performance by that company in Indianapolis before he went to Cornell, and then the company danced at Cornell. When the Cornell performance was over, little Newt was outside the stage door with a dozen long-stemmed American Beauty roses. The newspapers picked up the story when little Zinka asked for political asylum in the United States, and then she and little Newt disappeared. 1 week after that, little Zinka presented herself at the Russian embassy. She said Americans were too materialistic. She said she wanted to go back home. Newt took shelter in his sister's house in Indianapolis. He gave one brief statement to the press. It was a private matter, he said. It was an affair of the heart. I have no regrets. What happened is nobody's business but Zinka's and my own. One enterprising American reporter in Moscow, making inquiries about Zinka among dance people there, made the unkind discovery that Zinka was not, as she claimed, only 23 years old. She was 42, old enough to be Newt's mother. Chapter 9. Vice President in Charge of Volcanoes. I loafed on my book about the day of the bomb. About a year later, 2 days before Christmas, another story carried me through Ilium, New York, where Dr. Felix Honecker had done most of his work, where little Newt, Frank, and Angela had spent their formative years. I stopped off in Ilium to see what I could see. There were no live Honeckers left in Ilium, but there were plenty of people who claimed to have known well the old man and his three peculiar children. I made an appointment with Dr. Asa Breed, Vice President in charge of the Research Laboratory of the General Forge and Foundry Company. I suppose Dr. Breed was a member of my carass, too, though he took a dislike to me almost immediately. Likes and dislikes have nothing to do with it, says Bokonin, an easy warning to forget. I understand you were Dr. Honecker's supervisor during most of his professional life, I said to Dr. Breed on the telephone. On paper, he said. I don't understand, I said. If I actually supervise Felix, he said, then I'm ready now to take charge of volcanoes, the tides, and the migration of birds and lemmings. The man was a force of nature no mortal could possibly control. Chapter 10. Secret Agent X-9. Dr. Breed made an appointment with me for early the next morning. He would pick me up at my hotel on his way to work, he said, thus simplifying my entry into the heavily guarded research laboratory. So I had a night to kill in Ilium. I was already in the beginning and end of nightlife in Ilium, the Del Prado Hotel. Its bar, the Cape Cod Room, was a hangout for whores. As it happened, as it was meant to happen, Bokonin would say, the whore next to me at the bar and the bartender serving me had both gone to high school with Franklin Honecker, the bug tormentor, the middle child, the missing son. The whore, who said her name was Sandra, offered me delights unobtainable outside of Place Pigalle and Port Said. I said I wasn't interested, and she was bright enough to say that she wasn't really interested either. As things turned out, we had both overestimated our apathies, but not by much. Before we took the measure of each other's passions, however, we talked about Franklin Honecker, and we talked about the old man, and we talked a little about Asa Breed, and we talked about the General Forge and Foundry Company, and we talked about the Pope and birth control, about Hitler and the Jews. We talked about phonies, we talked about truth, we talked about gangsters, we talked about business, we talked about the nice poor people who went to the electric chair, and we talked about the rich bastards who didn't. We talked about religious people who had perversions. We talked about a lot of things. We got drunk. The bartender was very nice to Sandra. He liked her. He respected her. He told me that Sandra had been chairman of the class colors committee at Ilium High. Every class, he explained, got to pick distinctive colors for itself in its junior year, and then it got to wear those colors with pride. What colors did you pick? I asked. Orange and black. Those are good colors. I thought so. Was Franklin Honecker on the class colors committee, too? He wasn't on anything, said Sandra scornfully. He never got on any committee, never played any game, never took any girl out. I don't think he ever even talked to a girl. We used to call him Secret Agent X-9. X-9? You know, he was always acting like he was on his way between two secret places. Couldn't ever talk to anybody. Maybe he really did have a very rich secret life, I suggested. Nah, sneered the bartender. He was just one of those kids who made model airplanes and jerked off all the time. Chapter 11. Protein. He was supposed to be our commencement speaker, said Sandra. Who was? I asked. Dr. Honecker, the old man. What did he say? He didn't show up. So you didn't get a commencement address? Oh, we got one. Dr. Breed, the one you're going to see tomorrow, he showed up, all out of breath, and he gave some kind of talk. What did he say? He said he hoped a lot of us would have careers in science, she said. She didn't see anything funny in that. She was remembering a lesson that had impressed her. She was repeating it, gropingly, beautifully. He said, the trouble with the world was... She had to stop and think. The trouble with the world was, she continued hesitatingly, that people were still superstitious instead of scientific. He said if everybody would study science more, there wouldn't be all the trouble there was. He said science was going to discover the basic secret of life someday, the bartender put in. He scratched his head and frowned. Didn't I read in the paper the other day where they'd finally found out what it was? I missed that, I murmured. I saw that, said Sandra, about 2 days ago. That's right, said the bartender. What is the secret of life? I asked. I forget, said Sandra. Protein, the bartender declared. They found out something about protein. Yeah, said Sandra. That's it. Chapter 12. End of the World Delight. An older bartender came over to join in our conversation in the Cape Cod room of the Del Prado. When he heard that I was writing a book about the day of the bomb, he told me what the day had been like for him, what the day had been like in the very bar in which we sat. He had a W.C. Fields twang and a nose like a prize strawberry. It wasn't the Cape Cod room then, he said. We didn't have all these fucking nets and seashells around. It was called the Navajo Teepee in those days. Had Indian blankets and cow skulls on the walls. Had little tom-toms on the tables. People were supposed to beat on the tom-toms when they wanted service. They tried to get me to wear a war bonnet, but I wouldn't do it. Real Navajo Indian came in here one day. Told me Navajos didn't live in teepees. That's a fucking shame, I told him. Before that, it was the Pompeii room, with busted plaster all over the place. No matter what they call the room, they never change the fucking light fixtures. Never change the fucking people who come in, or the fucking town outside, either. The day they dropped Honecker's fucking bomb on the Japanese, a bum came in and tried to scrounge a drink. He wanted me to give him a drink on account of the world was coming to an end. So I mixed him an end-of-the-world delight. I gave him about a half a pint of creamed mint and a hollowed-out pineapple, with whipped cream and a cherry on top. There, you pitiful son of a bitch, I said to him. Don't ever say I never did anything for you. Another guy came in, and he said he was quitting his job at the research laboratory. Said anything a scientist worked on was sure to wind up as a weapon, one way or another. Said he didn't want to help politicians with their fucking wars anymore. Name was Breed. I asked him if he was any relation to the boss of the fucking research laboratory. He said he fucking well was. Said he was the boss of the research laboratory's fucking son. Chapter 13. The Jumping Off Place. Oh, God, what an ugly city Ilium is. Ah, God, says Bokonin, what an ugly city every city is. Sleet was falling through a motionless blanket of smog. It was early morning. I was riding in the Lincoln sedan of Dr. Asa Breed. I was vaguely ill, still a little drunk from the night before. Dr. Breed was driving. Tracks of a long-abandoned trolley system kept catching the wheels of his car. Breed was a pink old man, very prosperous, beautifully dressed. His manner was civilized, optimistic, capable, serene. I, by contrast, felt bristly, diseased, cynical. I had spent the night with Sandra. My soul seemed as foul as smoke from burning cat fur. I thought the worst of everyone, and I knew some pretty sordid things about Dr. Asa Breed, things Sandra had told me. Sandra told me everyone in Ilium was sure that Dr. Breed had been in love with Felix Honecker's wife. She told me that most people thought Breed was the father of all three Honecker children. "Do you know Ilium at all?" Dr. Breed suddenly asked me. "This is my first visit. It's a family town." "Sir, there isn't much in the way of nightlife. Everybody's life pretty much centers around his family and his home. That sounds very wholesome." "It is. We have very little juvenile delinquency." "Good. Ilium has a very interesting history, you know." "That's very interesting. It used to be the jumping-off place, you know?" "Sir?" "For the Western migration." "Oh. People used to get outfitted here." That's very interesting. Just about where the research laboratory is now was the old stockade. That was where they held the public hangings, too, for the whole county. I don't suppose crime paid any better then than it does now. There was one man they hanged here in 1782 who had murdered 26 people. I've often thought somebody ought to do a book about him sometime. George Minor Mokley. He sang a song on the scaffold. He sang a song he'd composed for the occasion. What was the song about? You can find the words over at the Historical Society if you're really interested. I just wondered about the general tone. He wasn't sorry about anything. Some people are like that. Think of it, said Dr. Breed. 26 people he had on his conscience. The mind reels, I said. Chapter 14. When automobiles had cut glass vases. My sick head wobbled on my stiff neck. The trolley tracks had caught the wheels of Dr. Breed's glossy Lincoln again. I asked Dr. Breed how many people were trying to reach the General Forge and Foundry Company by 8 o'clock, and he told me 30,000. Policemen in yellow rain capes were at every intersection, contradicting with their white-gloved hands what the stop-and-go signs said. The stop-and-go signs, garish ghosts in the sleet, went through their irreverent tomfoolery again and again, telling the glacier of automobiles what to do. Green meant go, red meant stop, orange meant change and caution. Dr. Breed told me that Dr. Honecker, as a very young man, had simply abandoned his car in Ilium traffic one morning. The police, trying to find out what was holding up the traffic, he said, found Felix's car in the middle of everything, its motor running, a cigar burning in the ashtray, fresh flowers in the vases. Vases? It was a Marmon, about the size of a switch engine. It had little cut-glass vases on the doorposts, and Felix's wife used to put fresh flowers in the vases every morning. And there that car was, in the middle of traffic. Like the Marie Celeste, I suggested. The police department hauled it away. They knew whose car it was, and they called up Felix, and they told him very politely where his car could be picked up. Felix told them they could keep it, that he didn't want it anymore. Did they? No. They called up his wife, and she came and got the Marmon. What was her name, by the way? Emily. Dr. Breed licked his lips. Then he got a faraway look, and then he said the name of the woman. Of the woman so long dead, again. Emily. Do you think anybody would object if I used the story about the Marmon in my book? I asked. As long as you don't use the end of it. The end of it? But Emily wasn't used to driving the Marmon. She got into a bad wreck on the way home. It did something to her pelvis. The traffic wasn't moving just then. Dr. Breed closed his eyes and tightened his hands on the steering wheel. And that was why she died when little Newt was born. Chapter 15. Merry Christmas. The research laboratory of the General Forge and Foundry Company was near the main gate of the company's Ilium Works, about a city block from the executive parking lot where Dr. Breed put his car. I asked Dr. Breed how many people worked for the research laboratory. 700, he said, but less than 100 are actually doing research. The other 600 are all housekeepers in one way or another, and I am the chiefest housekeeper of all. When we joined the mainstream of mankind in the company street, a woman behind us wished Dr. Breed a Merry Christmas. Dr. Breed turned to peer benignly into the sea of pale pies and identified the greeter as one Miss Francine Pefko. Miss Pefko was 20, vacantly pretty, and healthy, a dull normal. In honor of the dulcitude of Christmas time, Dr. Breed invited Miss Pefko to join us. He introduced her as the secretary of Dr. Nilsak Horvath. He then told me who Horvath was. The famous surface chemist, he said. The one who's doing such wonderful things with films. What's new in surface chemistry? I asked Miss Pefko. God, she said. Don't ask me. I just type what he tells me to type. And then she apologized for having said God. Oh, I think you understand more than you let on, said Dr. Breed. Not me. Miss Pefko wasn't used to chatting with someone as important as Dr. Breed, and she was embarrassed. Her gait was affected, becoming stiff and chicken-like. Her smile was glassy, and she was ransacking her mind for something to say, finding nothing in it but used Kleenex and costume jewelry. Well, rumbled Dr. Breed expansively, how do you like us, now that you've been with us, how long? Almost a year? You scientists think too much, blurted Miss Pefko. She laughed idiotically. Dr. Breed's friendliness had blown every fuse in her nervous system. She was no longer responsible. You all think too much. A winded, defeated-looking fat woman in filthy coveralls trudged beside us, hearing what Miss Pethco said. She turned to examine Dr. Breed, looking at him with helpless reproach. She hated people who thought too much. At that moment, she struck me as an appropriate representative for almost all mankind. The fat woman's expression implied that she would go crazy on the spot if anybody did any more thinking. "I think you'll find," said Dr. Breed, "that everybody does about the same amount of thinking. Scientists simply think about things in one way, and other people think about things in others."
"Ugh,"
gurgled Miss Pethco emptily. "I take dictation from Dr. Horvath, and it's just like a foreign language. I don't think I'd understand, even if I was to go to college. And here he's maybe talking about something that's going to turn everything upside down and inside out, like the atom bomb. When I used to come home from school, Mother used to ask me what happened that day, and I'd tell her," said Miss Pethco. "Now I come home from work, and she asks me the same question, and all I can say is..." Miss Pethco shook her head and let her crimson lips flap slackly. "I don't know, I don't know, I don't know." "If there's something you don't understand," urged Dr. Breed, "ask Dr. Horvath to explain it. He's very good at explaining." He turned to me. "Dr. Honecker used to say that any scientist who couldn't explain to an 8-year-old what he was doing was a charlatan." "Then I'm dumber than an 8-year-old, Miss Pethco mourned. "I don't even know what a charlatan is." Chapter 16. Back to Kindergarten. We climbed the 4 granite steps before the research laboratory. The building itself was of unadorned brick and rose 6 stories. We passed between 2 heavily armed guards at the entrance. Miss Pethco showed the guard on her left the pink confidential badge at the tip of her left breast. Dr. Breed showed the guard on the right the black top-secret badge on his soft lapel. Ceremoniously, Dr. Breed put his arm around me without actually touching me, indicating to the guards that I was under his august protection and control. I smiled at one of the guards. He did not smile back. There was nothing funny about national security, nothing at all. Dr. Breed, Miss Pethco, and I moved thoughtfully through the laboratory's grand foyer into the elevators. "Ask Dr. Horvath to explain something sometime," said Dr. Breed to Miss Pethco. "See if you don't get a nice, clear answer." "He'd have to start back in the first grade, or maybe even kindergarten," she said. "I missed a lot." "We all missed a lot," Dr. Breed agreed. "We'd all do well to start over again, preferably with kindergarten." We watched the laboratory's receptionist turn on the many educational exhibits that lined the foyer's walls. The receptionist was a tall, thin girl, icy, pale. At her crisp touch, lights twinkled, wheels turned, flasks bubbled, bells rang. "Magic!" declared Miss Pethco. "I'm sorry to hear a member of the laboratory family using that brackish medieval word," said Dr. Breed. "Every one of those exhibits explains itself. They're designed so as not to be mystifying. They're the very antithesis of magic."
"The very what of magic?"
"The exact opposite of magic."
"You couldn't prove it by me."
Dr. Breed looked just a little peeved. "Well," he said, "we don't want to mystify. At least give us credit for that." Chapter 17. The Girl Pool. Dr. Breed's secretary was standing on her desk in his outer office, tying an accordion-pleated Christmas bell to the ceiling fixture. "Look here, Naomi," cried Dr. Breed. "We've gone 6 months without a fatal accident. Don't you spoil it by falling off the desk." Miss Naomi Faust was a merry, desiccated old lady. I suppose she had served Dr. Breed for almost all his life, and her life, too. She laughed. "I'm indestructible. And even if I did fall, Christmas angels would catch me. They've been known to miss." 2 paper tendrils, also accordion-pleated, hung down from the clapper of the bell. Miss Faust pulled one. It unfolded stickily and became a long banner with a message written on it. "Here," said Miss Faust, handing the free end to Dr. Breed. "Pull it the rest of the way and tack the end to the bulletin board." Dr. Breed obeyed, stepping back to read the banner's message. "Peace on earth," he read out loud, heartily. Miss Faust stepped down from her desk with the other tendril, unfolding it. "Goodwill toward men," the other tendril said. "By golly," chuckled Dr. Breed. "They've dehydrated Christmas. The place looks festive, very festive." "And I remembered the chocolate bars for the girl pool, too," she said. "Aren't you proud of me?" Dr. Breed touched his forehead, dismayed by his forgetfulness. "Thank God for that. It slipped my mind." "We mustn't ever forget that," said Miss Faust. "It's tradition now.
Dr. Breed and his chocolate bars for the girl pool at Christmas. She explained to me that the girl pool was the typing bureau in the laboratory's basement. The girls belonged to anybody with access to a dictaphone. All year long, she said, the girls of the girl pool listened to the faceless voices of scientists on dictaphone records, records brought in by male girls. Once a year, the girls left their cloister of cement block to go a-caroling, to get their chocolate bars from Dr. Asa Breed. They serve science, too, Dr. Breed testified, even though they may not understand a word of it. God bless them, everyone. Chapter 18, The Most Valuable Commodity on Earth. When we got into Dr. Breed's inner office, I attempted to put my thoughts in order for a sensible interview. I found that my mental health had not improved, and when I started to ask Dr. Breed questions about the day of the bomb, I found that the public relations centers of my brain had been suffocated by booze and burning cat fur. Every question I asked implied that the creators of the atomic bomb had been criminal accessories to murder most foul. Dr. Breed was astonished, and then he got very sore. He drew back from me and he grumbled, I gather you don't like scientists very much. Well, I wouldn't say that, sir. All your questions seem aimed at getting me to admit that scientists are heartless, conscienceless, narrow boobies, indifferent to the fate of the rest of the human race, or maybe not really members of the human race at all. Well, that's putting it pretty strong. No stronger than what you're going to put in your book, apparently. I thought that what you were after was a fair, objective biography of Felix Honecker. Certainly as significant a task as a young writer could assign himself in this day and age. But no, you come here with preconceived notions about mad scientists. Where did you ever get such ideas? From the funny papers? From Dr. Honecker's son, to name one source. Which son? Newton, I said. I had little Newt's letter with me, and I showed it to him. How small is Newt, by the way? No bigger than an umbrella stand, said Dr. Breed, reading Newt's letter and frowning. The other two children are normal? Of course. I hate to disappoint you, but scientists have children just like anybody else's children. I did my best to calm down Dr. Breed, to convince him that I was really interested in an accurate portrait of Dr. Honecker. I've come here with no other purpose than to set down exactly what you tell me about Dr. Honecker. Newt's letter was just a beginning, and I'll balance off against it whatever you can tell me. I'm sick of people misunderstanding what a scientist is, what a scientist does. Well, I'll do my best to clear up the misunderstanding. In this country, most people don't even understand what pure research is. Well, I'd appreciate it if you'd tell me what it is. Well, it isn't looking for a better cigarette filter or a softer face tissue or a longer-lasting house paint, God help us. Everybody talks about research, and practically nobody in this country's doing it. We're one of the few companies that actually hires men to do pure research. When most other companies brag about their research, they're talking about industrial hack technicians who wear white coats, work out of cookbooks, and dream up an improved windshield wiper for next year's Oldsmobile. But here? Here, and shockingly few other places in this country, men are paid to increase knowledge, to work toward no end but that. Well, that's very generous of the General Forge and Foundry Company. Nothing generous about it. New knowledge is the most valuable commodity on earth. The more truth we have to work with, the richer we become. Had I been a Bokoninist then, that statement would have made me howl. Chapter 19. No More Mud. Do you mean, I said to Dr. Breed, that nobody in this laboratory is ever told what to work on? Nobody even suggests what they work on? People suggest things all the time, but it isn't in the nature of a pure research man to pay any attention to suggestions. His head is full of projects of his own, and that's the way we want it. But did anybody ever try to suggest projects to Dr. Honecker? Certainly. Admirals and generals in particular. They looked upon him as a sort of magician who could make America invincible with a wave of his wand. They brought all kinds of crackpot schemes up here. Still do. The only thing wrong with the schemes is that, given our present state of knowledge, the schemes won't work. Scientists on the order of Dr. Honecker are supposed to fill the little gaps. I remember, shortly before Felix died, there was a Marine general who was hounding him to do something about mud. Mud? The Marines, after almost 200 years of wallowing in mud, were sick of it, said Dr. Breed. The general, as their spokesman, felt that one of the aspects of progress should be that Marines no longer had to fight in mud. What did the general have in mind? The absence of mud, no more mud. I suppose, I theorized, It might be possible with mountains of some sort of chemical or tons of some sort of machinery. What the general had in mind was a little pill or a little machine. Not only were the Marines sick of mud, they were sick of carrying cumbersome objects. They wanted something little to carry for a change. What did Dr. Honecker say? In his playful way, and all his ways were playful, Felix suggested that there might be a single grain of something, even a microscopic grain, that could make infinite expanses of muck, marsh, swamp, creeks, pools, quicksand, and mire as solid as this desk. Dr. Breed banged his speckled old fist on the desk. The desk was a kidney-shaped, sea-green steel affair. One Marine could carry more than enough of the stuff to free an armored division bogged down in the Everglades. According to Felix, one Marine could carry enough of the stuff to do that under the nail of his little finger. That's impossible. You would say so. I would say so. Practically everybody would say so. To Felix, in his playful way, it was entirely possible. The miracle of Felix, and I sincerely hope you'll put this in your book somewhere, was that he always approached old puzzles as though they were brand new. I feel like Francine Pefko now, I said. And all the girls in the girl pool, too. Dr. Honecker could never have explained to me how something that could be carried under a fingernail could make a swamp as solid as your desk. I told you what a good explainer Felix was. Even so, he was able to explain it to me, said Dr. Breed. And I'm sure I can explain it to you. The puzzle is how to get Marines out of the mud, right? Right. All right, said Dr. Breed. Listen carefully. Here we go. Chapter 20. Ice 9. There are several ways, Dr. Breed said to me, in which certain liquids can crystallize, can freeze. Several ways in which their atoms can stack and lock in an orderly, rigid way. That old man, with spotted hands, invited me to think of the several ways in which cannonballs might be stacked on a courthouse lawn, of the several ways in which oranges might be packed into a crate. So it is with atoms in crystals, too. And two different crystals of the same substance can have quite different physical properties. He told me about a factory that had been growing big crystals of ethylene diamine tartrate. The crystals were useful in certain manufacturing operations, he said. But one day, the factory discovered that the crystals it was growing no longer had the properties desired. The atoms had begun to stack and lock, to freeze, in different fashion. The liquid that was crystallizing hadn't changed, but the crystals it was forming were, as far as industrial applications went, pure junk. How this had come about was a mystery. The theoretical villain, however, was what Dr. Breed called a seed. He meant by that a tiny grain of the undesired crystal pattern. The seed, which had come from God only knows where, taught the atoms the novel way in which to stack and lock, to crystallize, to freeze. Now think about cannonballs on a courthouse lawn, or about oranges in a crate again, he suggested. And he helped me to see that the pattern of the bottom layers of cannonballs or of oranges determined how each subsequent layer would stack and lock. The bottom layer is the seed of how every cannonball or every orange that comes after is going to behave, even to an infinite number of cannonballs or oranges. Now suppose, chortled Dr. Breed, enjoying himself, that there were many ways in which water could crystallize, could freeze. Suppose that the sort of ice we skate upon and put into highballs, what we might call ice one, is only one of several types of ice. Suppose water always froze as ice one on Earth because it never had a seed to teach it how to form ice two, ice three, ice four. And suppose, he rapped on his desk with his old hand again, that there were one form, which we will call ice nine, a crystal as hard as this desk, with a melting point of, let us say, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, or, better still, a melting point of 130 degrees. All right, I'm still with you, I said. Dr. Breed was interrupted by whispers in his outer office, whispers loud and portentous. They were the sounds of the girl pool. The girls were preparing to sing in the outer office. And they did sing, as Dr. Breed and I appeared in the doorway. Each of about 100 girls had made herself into a choir girl by putting on a collar of white bond paper, secured by a paper clip. They sang beautifully. I was surprised and mawkishly heartbroken. I am always moved by that seldom used treasure, the sweetness with which most girls can sing. The girls sang, O Little Town of Bethlehem, and I am not likely to forget very soon their interpretation of the line, The hopes and fears of all the years are here with us tonight.